Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show. I'm Robert Band, and as we reach the end of August, we're getting ready to switch our sandals for sweatshirts. As the leaves turn gold and the days get shorter, meaning there's plenty of long evenings to be spent lost in the pages of a good book, dancing around your kitchen to a blinding new album, or being dazzled by a spectacle on screen. But what is coming our way this autumn? Well, we've invited in three cultural clairvoyants to tell us what you'll be reading, listening to and watching over the next few months. And they are the film critic Simran Hans, broadcaster and DJ Georgie Rogers, and head of literature and spoken word at the South Bank Centre, Ted Hodgkinson. Georgie, Simran and Ted, welcome to the programme. How have your summers been?
Great.
It seems a bit sad to be talking about golden leaves and switching sandals for sweatshirts.
I know.
I'm not ready to say goodbye to the heat wave.
I know. Neither am I.
I'm planning on wearing sandals well into September.
So yeah, will you be sporting a sock with that?
White ones, yes.
Yeah, white ones. Okay.
Just to keep it fresh.
Georgie, in fact, we're going to start with you and music. Something new from Cat Power, hitting in October.
Yes.
Oh, I'm always so excited about anything new from Cat Power.
So
how
am
does
I.
This one sound?
This one sounds great. I also just, I got to interview her.
Lovely.
One of the first interviews that she's given about this album. And I was on the phone to her for like 45 minutes. And at the end, it was like I made a new friend.
Ah.
So I'm going to be very, very positive about this. But because it's an incredible album, it's absolutely beautiful. And it's her first in 6 years. It's her 10th album. You don't get, Cat Power very often. It's not a saturated market, I suppose, as far as she's concerned. But she always kind of does come up with the goods, doesn't she, when she does release an album. And this one came off the back of Sun. So she finished Sun, that came out in 2012, and then she went on the road touring, and she, in and around having her first child, she just spent some time kind of alone with her instrument, and that enforced the new record, like Movement and Wandering, and the title is Wanderer.
If I were to kind of conjure up the title of any Cat Power album that hadn't been made, Wanderer might be where I'd start title-wise.
Yeah. I think with this one she's kind of, she said that she wanted it to feel like a whole album and feel like a journey and to feel like a kind of capsule. And so that's why I think she took her time. She wanted to give it sort of protection of care and just kind of let these songs sit and breathe for a bit. Instrumentally, it's quite sparse in parts. It's really rich in others. It's quite folky. It's quite, like, it reminded me at times of Feist's latest album, Pleasure, which was a brilliant album. But the kind of fragility of it, it's a little bit raw. It's, as all Cat Power is, very personal. She is a genius when it comes to melody, and she's such a powerful storyteller. And she does have just a God-given voice that is just, I don't know, it's liquid honey, isn't it? To keep, for your goal is ages up for the end of your story. Give my hand to Jesus and we'll hand away you. Oh, wonder, happy wandering. So that's the title track, Wanderer. Yeah, kind of classic form. It's sort of like the opening little piece, which then comes full circle at the end. There's a cover of Rihanna, Stay, which is a brilliant pop ballad.
Like, yeah. Now I'm interested.
Yeah, right? It's an amazing song. And when I was interviewing her, I was asking her about why she chose to do it, because she's done it in such a Cat Power way. It sounds so Cat Power. She said that she'd heard it in a cab and it brought her to tears. It's the first time she'd heard it. She doesn't hear that much kind of contemporary pop music. And then after she'd had her kids, she was kind of desperate to get out of the house, so she went to a karaoke spot. She said she used to do karaoke back in her 20s on her own. She'd just go to like a little Korean place. And just saying, can you imagine seeing Cat Power? I mean, her voice is insane. And this one, she said she went and just sang Stay 17 times. And so that's made it on the album, which is, it's just brilliant.
That's a good, I love a bit of creation myth for a cover version, right? That's amazing.
Yeah, you can just imagine her. Yeah. She's just, need to get
you wish you were there, don't you?
Yeah,
I do too.
I do.
Georgie Rogers' recommendation is Cat Power, Wanderer. That's out in October, on October the 5th, in fact. Georgie, Spiritualize. We've got something new coming out in September. Talk us through this one.
Yeah, so this, again, first new album in 6 years. And this sounds like it was quite a grueling journey for Mr. Jason Pierce. He made the whole thing by himself on a computer. Just a one-man band, essentially.
And the Sat Spiritualized sound, people may or may not know, yeah, it's huge, it's orchestral, it's lush, it's yeah, all the rest of it.
It's all
and he's
the
always
things.
Presumably had all the orchestration and all the band members, or at least hired musicians. So trying to do the whole thing off a,
yeah,
off a MacBook.
Yeah, in his house.
Is a challenge.
Yeah. So he said it was a very like painstaking and frustrating process. And as the record was being made, it was touted that it might be the last.
Mm.
And he has said, I mean, it was such hard work that he doesn't really know whether it is going to be the last. But
he's got a promising future in
yeah,
IT.
Yeah.
Which is a shame because I reviewed this one for the magazine and I think this is an amazing record.
Yes.
I love this.
Yeah.
It's a hooky, proper record.
Definitely. And you can just imagine him kind of sitting there in his house. Because on I'm Your Man, which is one of the first tasters of it, which is straight away it went on loads of different radio stations, was being played. It's an amazing song.
Yeah.
And there's just this stunning guitar solo. We kind of just shredding. You can just imagine him kind of, yeah, building this really intricate track, just probably going crazy over every little note and every little sound and everything. But yeah, it sounds very kind of transcendent and uplifting and sort of like these little like mini symphonies in a way, which he does so well. I mean, like Ladies and Gentlemen, We're Floating in Space, that's now become a sort of seminal album.
Yeah.
Of, was it 1997, which was a great year. Loads of good stuff came out
pretty
that
good,
year.
Yeah.
OK Computer, Be Here Now by Oasis.
Some of them have aged better than others. Looking back, we go, OK, Computer and Spice.
Yeah. But I think there's the kind of definitely some similar thing. I mean, he does talking about love very well. And the video for I'm Your Man is him kind of looking a bit like a sort of sad spaceman in a spacesuit wandering around the desert. Very beautiful video. And very complimentary to the track. But there's, yeah, those themes of space and love.
All the spiritualized leitmotifs
are yeah,
ticked off. Georgie, let's have a clip. This is Here It Comes, The Road. Let's go. That can't be made on a laptop, surely.
Well,
or can it?
Apparently, he really did have to learn everything from scratch. There's a quote of him saying, "The biggest thing for me was to try and make it sound like a studio session. But I was new to it all. I didn't have the shortcuts people use as like when they're making records. I just sat there for weeks, for months, moving every level a bit up, a bit, just trying to get the sounds right." So, yeah.
It's all right, yeah. I'm a two-fingered typer,
yeah,
but I do a lot of it. I don't know how I haven't got better. Anyway, spiritualized and Nothing Hurt is fantastic stuff. It's out on the 7th of September. Georgie, thank you very much indeed. Ted, it's Book O'Clock, Enigma Variations by Andre Achiman, the author of Call Me By Your Name. That's how everyone will possibly know him, having maybe not read that novel or maybe read it after the film came out. What's his style as a writer? Where's he coming from?
He writes these beautiful, long Proustian sentences that linger in the memory, and I think he's someone who, as a stylist, can be quite spare. He's at his best when he's writing about the body, I think, and he writes these really achingly sad and direct and visceral chapters here about the body. And he writes brilliantly, which is a very hard thing to do. He writes brilliantly about sex and carnal relationships without any sentimentality and with a real kind of lucidity and precision. So he's a really excellent stylist. And I think perhaps if you've seen Call Me By Your Name and not read him yet,
yeah,
you might not know that. But I think for fans of Call Me By Your Name, the good news is that this book does explore similar territory, but it's a more distilled and in some ways a bolder book. It's less linear than Call Me By Your Name. It's about a man called Paul, and it's really about five defining relationships through his entire life. And you see the sort of ebb and flow of his romantic life. And it's a meditation on love, and it's a meditation on the way that that kind of shatters and shapes us. And it's both incredibly sad and moving, and shows you the kind of evolution of his self and a fragmentary self that he kind of tries to almost find in these relationships, these glimmers of himself coming back from each of these relationships. But it's also a hopeful book, full of tenderness, full of connection as well as loneliness.
It's a great idea for a novel, isn't it? I suppose to kind of to go through these kind of five steps. Is there sort of something of self-help and self-harm about this kind of thing? And there's something about fluid sexuality in this novel and a reflection on who you are now and the constituent parts of where that might have come from.
Yeah, his first love is with a man, Giovanni, and that's, as is often said, it's the sort of visceral wound that it defines a lot of what comes next. And there's this beautiful sentence early on where he says that he's the boat which basically got his running lights going and then he left, and that this boat then kind of continues through the rest of his life. As you say, he falls in love with people of both sexes, and each of those relationships leaves a different impression and different mark. And in a sense, gender is almost fades in the novel into the background. Ideas of what, you know, whether that's a barrier or a kind of, it becomes really secondary to the sort of calibration of each feeling and love and how intense that is. And there's a moment later in the book when he's has been in a relationship with a man called Manfred, and he then enters an affair with a woman. Each of them are consuming in different ways. Andre Assiman is a brilliant, a sort of magus of the human heart, really. He understands the kind of capriciousness of human emotions and how we can feel one thing and something completely contradictory at the same time, with sometimes the same force, maybe a bit like Cat Power in that respect.
Yeah.
You know, shows us the contradictions in our feelings and emotions. But I found this book really extraordinarily powerful and moving by the end of it, because you're...
Despite having a character called Manfred. how are we meant to go for that one?
When it pops up, you're like, Manfred is sort of like a farcical
name. Get turned on by this guy.
Yes, I mean, it's true. Manfred isn't necessarily the most sort of lyrical name. But yeah, I guess he... there is humour in the book as well. You know, there is the sort of... I mean, it does become... There's a slightly kind of mordant wit that creeps in towards the end when he becomes a bit more gnarled by all of these relationships. And the last section is called Abingdon Square. And that's by far the darkest of them. And, you know, he starts off by getting this email from an old lover, and it begins, "Dearest." And a lot of it is this meditation on the word "dearest" and how out of step it feels with him now. He's like, am I anyone's dearest? Is that a thing? So it becomes much more flinty and kind of world-weary as you go on, I suppose. But it's those middle sections where he's writing about the body and writing about those relationships are they really build in this cumulatively achingly sad way. So.
Beautiful stuff. Mm. That is Enigma Variations by Andre Assiman. Am I pronouncing?
I think it's Assiman.
Assiman. It's a good story, beautifully told, and by Ted.
Thank you.
Right. Now, when it comes to best title of the year for a novel, let's put a fiver on this one. Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead. This is by Olga Tokarczuk. Talk us through this one, Ted.
Olga Tokarczuk, who won earlier in the year the Man Booker International Prize for Flights, which she described as a constellation novel, in that it was a series of moments that capture international travel of one kind or another, which has a special kind of resonance for someone who grew up in the sort of Soviet world and sphere where travel really wasn't possible. This is a different kind of constellation novel. I would say it is also a constellation novel. It's about a woman called Janina who lives rurally in the Polish woods. She's a former bridge engineer who kind of sets her star by William Blake and has this really interesting cosmology, kind of really inspired and infused by Blake's poetry of energy and signs. She, like the author Tokarczuk, is a sort of visionary woman, and she sees things in the forest that she defines with words that have capitalized letters. So she has this whole cosmology of signs that she's seeing. She's also interested in astrology. What then starts to unfold is a kind of noirish caper around her. So she's living this very rural existence surrounded by men that she uses epithets to describe rather than actual names, so Bigfoot and Oddball and these characters who are slightly mythic and larger than life. But there's a sort of almost detective thrillerish part to this, which is that in this very visionary woodland scenario, she starts witnessing deaths. Many of these deaths are animal deaths, and she sees this through her Blakean lens as a kind of holocaust, that these animals are being killed and that there are hunters all around her. And then it transpires that, in fact, she starts seeing the hunters themselves, the chief of police even, have been killed. And in her visionary way, sees a link between the murder of the animals and the murder of these hunters, and believes and writes very carefully worded letters to the police to say that these men have been killed, in fact, by the animals, by the deer, and that the police declined to respond to these letters. And you infer from their silence that they're treating this as a kind of crackpot theory that doesn't have any basis in reality. Essentially, it's a story about cruelty, and it's a story, a meditation upon our different kinds of cruelty and the ways in which we perpetrate that cruelty without realising it. And I think the reason that Blake is so central to all of this, and Blake, we should say, is the reason the book has... the title is drawn from Blake. That quote is from Blake. So, "Draw your plough over the bones of the dead," is a line from William Blake. And a lot of his poetry asks us to question our morality and to ask where we're kind of ploughing our energy, as it were, and into what other beings are we doing that.
And there's his kind of fugue state, which seems like she seems to be in Blake's kind of, like John Clare or someone, that kind of idea of kind of getting into this particular creative trance through walking or through being in a super rural place, which she seems to be channeling.
John Clare is a brilliant comparison because has, you know, visionary moments, which at the time he was considered a total crackpot.
Nutter.
And in fact, he was, and his poetry now has this sort of lucidity and clarity and attunes us to the natural world in ways that weren't really appreciated then. And I think in this book, you know, there are these absolutely stunning passages which reflect on, you know, the simple natural cycles of the woods around her and how that's being disturbed. And it does really attune you to that. The other thing that it does, and I should say one of the really playful and barbed and enjoyable bits of the book, is the way that Janina's perspective shows the sexism and misogyny that's also at play here. And she has this really nice phrase for the men that she encounters in her in the woods, which she describes as having... testosterone autism is what she describes it as, that they are totally testosterone dominated. You know, it's her way of kind of explaining their very dominating and violent behaviour to her.
Title and euphemism of the year award goes to Olga Tokarczuk. Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead by Olga Tokarczuk is out on September the 12th. It's published by Fitzcarraldo, and Enigma Variations by Andre Assiman is published by Faber. Ted, thank you very much. Simran, welcome to the programme.
Hi, nice
first
to be
time.
Here.
So what's going to be exciting you as the leaves fall from the trees? You've chosen something pretty exciting from Desiree Akhavan.
Yeah, so Desiree Akhavan is an Iranian-American filmmaker born in New York, grew up there, but now she's based here in London. And she made her debut film, I think in 2014, a film called Appropriate Behaviour, which she also starred in. And it was a kind of coming-of-age film that was compared to Girls. And it was very funny, very frank about sexuality and all about her being a bisexual Iranian-American, kind of having to deal with all of that stuff. And her latest film is called The Miseducation of Cameron Post. It's an adaptation of a YA novel by Emily Danforth. I think that book came out around 2012. Mm-hmm. It's about a girl called Cameron, and she is a kind of Midwest teenager who is caught kissing her best friend, who happens to be a girl, and she gets sent away to a Christian conversion camp to pray away the gay. So it's all about her experiences in this weird culty camp where everybody who sort of works there and is kind of trying to be cured there feels like they have this this thing that they can't deal with, and it's kind of framed as a sickness. They call it SSA, same-sex attraction, which is a kind of dark, funny way of thinking about sexuality.
Yeah. Shall we have a bit of a clip?
Yeah.
This is from The Miseducation of Cameron Post.
The first step is for you to stop thinking of yourself as a homosexual.
I don't think of myself as a homosexual. I don't really think of myself as anything.
I'm tired of feeling disgusted with myself.
The lead actress is Chloe Grace Moretz, who, you know, was famous for being in Kick-Ass when she was just a youngster, swearing away. but she was also in a film called The Clouds of Sils Maria, She's been in a couple of other things. She was in a remake of Carrie, and I've never seen her like this. I didn't know she could do this kind of acting. It's a very internalized performance. It's all kind of held within. She's got these hunched shoulders that are really tense, and her eyes are very squinty, and she doesn't have a lot of dialogue. But the sort of self-loathing that she manages to convey throughout the performance is really incredible. And, you know, I spoke to Desiree Akhavan about this film. I interviewed her, and she described it as kind of born out of her experiences in rehab when she had bulimia. And so it's about sort of thinking of something that is so fundamental to your identity, like your sexuality, as something that you think you could be cured of, but you can't. And the mode of it is very, it's kind of like if you pulled a John Hughes movie into the 90s and made it gay.
I would definitely be up for that. I'm totally down with that. It seems like, despite it wears its themes seriously, but it, with a frilly bit of comedy as well, presumably.
It's very funny. There's lots of period details. It's set in 1994. There's like an amazing karaoke sequence.
Georgie, let's watch it together.
Yeah, there's a great scene with a song by the Four Non Blondes, karaoke scene. Another karaoke scene with a Celine Dion song that I won't spoil. And yeah, it's all kind of set around a time when, you know, the AIDS crisis is kind of still raging, and it's in the background, and Bill Clinton is about to become president. And yeah, it's a period film, and the clothes are terrible. There are some really hideous denim jackets.
What, are we calling it like triple denim?
Yeah, there's also a really funny sort of parody of Jane Fonda-style exercise videos that are, like, God-themed. They're called Blesser-size. And so they, like, pray and work out. It's very funny. There's lots of funny details. But, you know, it's a really moving film as well. And it just really captures the way that teenagers just hate themselves.
Yeah.
I'm imagining them all in Canadian tuxedos now, the whole film.
You've got it.
It's too good to be true. It's The Miseducation of Cameron Post, directed by Desiree Akhavan. Simran, next up, you've chosen Matingi Maya, and this is a documentary about MIA.
You've got access to a microphone. Please use it to say something. We're used as scapegoats to build a wall, but people have always mixed and moved, and interesting things happen because of it.
And that was a clip from Matingi Maya, M-I-A. Simran, another kind of always kind of fascinating, headline-grabbing artist. How did she come across in this documentary?
Well, there's a scene quite early on in the film where the director, a guy called Steve Loveridge, who sort of for context is friends with Maya. They sort of came of age together because they were at Central St. Martin's at the same time in the late 90s, and that's how they met. And so he's her friend making this film about her. So, you know, there's a context there. And early on in the film, he asks her in a sort of tongue-in-cheek way, why are you a problematic pop star? And that really kind of frames the film. It's all about, why do people kind of perceive her in this way as a sort of troublemaker? And what is she trying to do? What are her aims? What's her background? And how has she been kind of misunderstood? But what it does that's interesting is that it's not a documentary that's a promotional tool. You know, it's not something that's trying to sell her to the audience. And it's also very different to have a film about an artist who's living. So many documentaries, music documentaries, are about artists who are dead. And so she's still an artist, she's still making work. It's kind of compiled of all this footage that she shot all throughout her life. She was a sort of serial documentarian herself. So there's clips of her, you know, visiting Sri Lanka, where she's from. There's clips of her interviewing her family, her brothers and sisters, and her mum in their house in Hounslow, her working on her music videos. She used to shoot behind the scenes footage for Elastica.
And is that right?
Yeah, so she's kind of like friends with all these interesting people. There's a bit when Spike Jones interviews her in the back of a cab. And so you get to see all these sort of moments where she's being creative and interesting. But also there are those tentpole instances where we think of MIA is, yeah, like I said, a troublemaker. So the whole Super Bowl fiasco, yeah, where she stuck her middle finger up on live TV and then the NFL tried to sue her for $16 million. So you see all of that unfolding. It's hilarious. It's so funny. But, I mean, it's obviously only funny with hindsight because it almost derailed her career. It's just very interesting that it's assembled from loads of stuff that she shot herself. So there's a sense of authorship and it's in the spirit of the artist, which I don't think is the case for a lot of music documentaries.
And MIA, I don't know, I love her music. I think she's kind of like quite a beguiling artist in all sorts of ways. She's not Madonna, she's not Amy Winehouse, or George Michael even, who obviously have been documented recently. What is does this kind of cut through to people that aren't necessarily fans of her music?
I think her story is so interesting. You know, she came to the UK from Sri Lanka as a refugee. And so it's a fascinating kind of time capsule of politics in the UK in the 90s and early noughties. And she's an interesting character. So I think people who aren't fans of her will maybe be intrigued. But if you are a fan of her, it will just reinvigorate your love for her. I mean, I really like her. Haven't really thought about her in a little while. Watched this film at the Berlin Film Festival in February and just immediately walked out of there and had to listen to Kala again because it's an amazing record. And her music is just highlighted in a way in this film that makes you think, like, why isn't she bigger? Why isn't she more like Amy Winehouse or Madonna?
That is Matangi Maya, M-I-A, is out on the 21st of September. Simran, thank you very much. We just have a couple of minutes to do a quick round the table thing. Georgie, what else is on your radar for the autumn?
I think like 2018 has been a really, really, really strong year for music and there's still quite a few big hitters coming our way. Christine and the Queens album, Chris, is sounding brilliant. Telemann's album, Family of Aliens, I'm looking forward to. There's new Bob Moses coming. Jungle are back with sort of more of the same, bangers on bangers. Orbital, Villages, the first signs of their new record is stunning. And then there's also Reduxa, which is the hip-hop reworking of Alt-J's album, Relaxer.
Oh, wow.
Which I'm actually really excited about. I think that's going to be pretty interesting.
Sounds good, right?
Yeah, but in a good way.
Let's add Kurt Vile to that list.
Kurt Vile.
Because that's a lovely sounding record. I think out in October as well.
Yeah.
Super.
That's loads of good stuff.
Lovely. Ted, what's on your radar for the autumn?
I haven't mentioned Essig Dunian's book, Washington Black, which is coming out in October as well. And that's a fantastic and sort of fantastical but also very serious novel about the history of slavery, but done in a way that is, like Colson Whitehead's The Railroad Underground, quite surprisingly surreal at times. And also it's a sort of reflection on freedom and the perils of freedom, as well as it's a really interesting and surprising novel, which has already been longlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Another book which I'm really excited about, which is a completely different direction, is the Beastie Boys book, which is coming out in November from Faber. And I think what they've...
Is it done like an annual?
Well, what they've managed to do is do something really faithful to the kind of scrapbook style, pull all your influences into one kind of compendious journal style, almost ragbag book, basically, which has got photos, it's got diary entries, it's got scraps of paper that are like almost like sketches on the back of pizza boxes style entries. So it feels like you're kind of really in the sort of studio with them and going through it all with them. And it's a lot of fun.
Nice. Simran, what is exciting you other than MIA and Cameron Post?
Well, so I'm off to Toronto for the Toronto International Film Festival in 2 weeks, which I'm really excited about. And there are a couple of films that are playing there that will get a release later on in the autumn. One that I'm weirdly excited about is A Star Is Born, starring Lady Gaga and directed, bizarrely enough, by Bradley Cooper.
What?
It's his directorial
debut.
It's like
debut. I woke up, I had a dream that someone had made this film. And it exists.
It exists. It's what I've been waiting for my whole life. No, I think Bradley Cooper is such a weird, fascinating Hollywood person to me. I don't understand him. I don't understand the films that he's in and the choices that he makes. And so I think this will be a kind of anti-La La Land kind of thing. It looks like it's going to take itself very seriously. And I kind of love that. I love a classic Oscar baity, serious movie like that.
Thank you very much indeed. That brings us to the end of today's show. Run out of time, gang. Thanks very much to my guests, Simran Hans, Ted Hodgkinson and Georgie Rogers. Thanks, of course, to my producer, Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week and we'll be giving the new album by Anna Calvi a spin. But until then, from me, Robert Bound, thank you very much for tuning in.